So. Mean value theorem. So, this gets used a bit in calculus, but probably not a lot when you're not being asked to actually prove stuff. It can come up a little bit. It should be covered, but probably don't spend a ton of time on it. When I do cover it in Calculus 1, I try to make it real for my students, so I say something like, if I drove, 100 miles in, let's say, 2 hours, then there has to be an instant in time where my speedometer said I was going exactly 50 miles an hour, right? It says that the average change over some interval of time, I usually think of it as time interpreted, also matches the instantaneous rate of change at some moment in time. Average rate equals instantaneous rate at some instant. That's the big idea of section 5.3. And you actually want to prove this. You have to put some reasonable hypotheses on this. You better have a derivative if we want to talk about instantaneous rate of change and so on. So how about this? If f is continuous, that's the thing I get lazy and write as CTS sometimes, right? On, say, a closed interval A to B, and differentiable, maybe I'll get that lazy and abbreviate that as DIFF. You don't need it to be differentiable at the endpoints, but at least have it be differentiable at all the interior points. Then you can find some point in between the endpoints such that that average rate of change, which would be total change in F divided, so total change in output divided by total change in input. If you like, think of A as the start time and B as the end time, right? F can be my starting position, B can be my ending position, 100 miles further. B minus A would be the 2 hours, right? Then that is supposed to equal this instantaneous rate of change, the F prime of C. The formula is going to look like that. Okay, if you want to get really picky, don't let this be a one-point interval, right? Because then the interior would be empty, and that would make this all rather ridiculous. But
So the interval should have some positive width. So A should be less than B strictly. All right.
There's a picture of the meaning of the theorem in the book as well, right? I like to tell my students about the average rate of change, but you can also talk about the slope. Here, I can draw a function that maybe it has a vertical tangent line or something at the end point, at one of the endpoints or something, so it's actually not differentiable at the end point. Nonetheless, draw a straight line between the endpoints of the graph at A and at B. And so you're saying now what? Right? You're saying that there should actually be points with tangent, well, at least one point with a tangent line that corrects slope. there's no implied claim of uniqueness here, right? We're just asserting there's one, but possibly many points with the matching slope. In my picture, there's, looks like 4 points, I think, if I draw it right. There's 4 points that actually have a tangent line at the correct slope.
In general, could just be one, could be, uncountably many or anything in between, I think. Now,
the idea here is it's nice. It's visually plausible once I draw a graph, and and what I said about my little road trip of 100 miles and that, all that with a speedometer, that's plausible too.
So I can get my students to believe it. Probably can't get them to sit through a proof. How does it actually get proved though, if you've gone beyond calculus to advanced calculus, right?
How do you hope to prove something like this? There's a standard move, and this kind of move gets used over and over and over again in this section.
What Abbott does over and over again is, instead of directly working with a function f and trying to prove the derivative is some number at such and such a point,
what he does is he modifies things. He looks at a related but easier function. It's generally easier to find an argument that guarantees you a horizontal tangent line, a slope of zero, than it is to match some particular slanted slope. You have some tools. 5.2. I didn't cover this, as I recall last time, but the interior extremum theorem. If f of c is an extreme value, so a maximum or a minimum, of f on the open interval from a to b, then the derivative at c is zero. Okay, under some assumption, right? Assuming your function is differentiable on that interval, And, okay, we don't want to do something stupid here, so we're assuming that that point C is actually in the integral, right? Again, very plausible, right? If you have a minimum value, then you should have a horizontal tangent line. Same if you have a maximum value. We don't assume anything about the endpoints in this case, right? They could go off to infinity or something as you approach the endpoint A or the endpoint B. But if f of c is the lowest value or the highest value the function takes, then yeah, of course you should have this. And there's a standard way of proving it, right? You have c, and then you have some other numbers over here. Say, x, y. As x approaches c from the left, the difference quotient f of c minus f of x. If it exists, it has to be negative. Right? And we know it exists because we're assuming the derivative exists. Right? What happens? Okay, from the left, you have negative slopes, right? So in the limit, well, it could go to zero in the limit. And a priori, it could go to a negative number, but because of the other side, it can't go to a negative number. But a limit of negative things can't converge to a positive thing. That's the order limit theorem. And then you approach from the other side, where the slopes are positive. On the one hand, from the left, you see that at a minimum, the derivative, if it exists, can't be positive. But then when you approach from the right, you see the derivative, since it's a limit of positive slopes, can't be negative. Maybe if I switch these around, it'll be a little less weird looking, so that at least we're going from the I want to have the points go from left to right so that the denominator is positive, right? See, if I write it this way, yeah, c minus x is positive, y minus c is also positive. And what happens? Right? Well, this number here, the numerator, f of c minus f of x, f of c is the minimum. So whatever this number is, it's going to have to be less than or equal to zero. F of c is the minimum. The minimum minus anything else will be zero or less. Here, it's the other way around. You're subtracting the minimum value from some other value, so it has to be at least a zero. So remember that limits preserve weak inequalities. A limit will not necessarily preserve a strict less or a strict greater than, but it will preserve a less than or equal to. It will preserve a greater than or equal to. And down here, I arrange things from left to right, so to speak, right? Subtracting the left number from the right number, that's positive. That's positive. that
you can write it up a little prettier than that, right? A little more organized. And the book has already done a better write-up, right? I don't need to repeat it verbatim, right? This is in section 5.2. You see the idea? Okay. So somehow, I'm going to use this, right? Here's my picture here. I need to get rid of the slant, right? How does Abbott do it? How does he turn a slanted picture like this into a picture where you actually want a C at a minimum or a maximum? How does he get us into this situation? How does he modify F? What's the modified function G?
The difference quotient, the rest of the equation from f of x.
Mm-hmm. And that's the formula.
Now, why would that be a good idea? I mean, if you were trying to come up with a proof yourself, you know, why would you think that? So we have to be careful here. How is it actually written?
It's in brackets.
Yeah. This and times what?
X minus A.
Yeah, times X minus A.
And then plus F of A.
Plus F of A. Where is that formula coming from? Is it plus or minus?
The first one is subtraction.
Yes. Yes.
And any other brackets or anything?
Yeah. It's brackets around the difference quotient all the way to the end, mm-hmm. and then parentheses around the difference quotient.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure those parentheses are strictly necessary, but. Okay. This thing in the brackets, right? What is that when you look at my picture over here? What is that? Yeah, that's the slope. This is a formula involving x, right? So I could graph this, right? What does the graph of this bracketed thing correspond to in the picture?
F of B?
The distance between B and A.
So F is this thing, right? Okay, look at the kind of equation you have. This big fraction, it may look intimidating, but A and B are constants. This is just a constant. So this is a constant times x minus a constant times a constant plus a constant. So in the end, it's some constant times x plus another constant. The graph of such a thing, right, is a what?
A line.
Yeah, two constants. Yeah, it's a line. And it's not just any line. It's exactly the line right here. That's where the formula came from. It's just the formula for the line that goes through A, comma, F of A, and B, comma, F of B. The endpoints of our graph here. So then this function G, what it's actually doing, G is the difference in the y-coordinates.
between the curve and the line. So G is positive in this part of the picture. Down here, G would be negative, right? So the idea is, look at the place where the vertical difference or distance between the line and the graph is greatest. And right there, our hunch is that that's the point we want. That's how the proof goes. And that's how you actually come up with this thing, right? And essentially subtracting off this line, right, undoes the slanting, right? It sort of tilts the graph. Not really tilts. The proper term would be something more like a skew, right? But so something like that for G, right? Well, I got a question. Actually, G starts and ends at zero, right? Okay, so I mean, maybe you have to think back to some high school stuff about how do you find the formula for a line, but that's all that's going on here. It wasn't super hard labor for somebody to come up with the magic formula. It's just a line.
Okay. And why is this better, right? Because you can apply Rolle's theorem to it. And yeah, usual stuff, like don't be unreasonable, have A be strictly less than B, so it's a non-trivial interval. So same hypotheses as in the mean value theorem. If you're continuous all the way from end to end, including the endpoints, and differentiable everywhere in between, but then one extra hypothesis, if you have the same starting and ending height, like our G does, then you get what you need. For some C strictly in between A and B, the derivative of G is zero. And how do you prove it? Well, you use that interior extremum theorem over there. The idea is, okay, let's just look at wherever the minimum or maximum of G might be, right? But how do you know, right? Okay, in my picture, this is the min and this is the max, right? There's some other places where the derivative is zero, but all we need is one. Alright. Now, okay, definitely those places, if they're not at the endpoints, should be places with horizontal tangent lines. You would have a problem if, say, the maximum was at an endpoint, then you couldn't use it. Right? Because maybe I have a graph. Maybe the graph is actually a straight line. It starts here and just goes straight up to here. Right?
Okay, is that allowed? No, because the levels have to be the same. But here's a better one. Think about a parabola, okay? And let's say I have it start and end at the same height, so it makes this dip, right? The maximums happen at the end point, right? That's where the maximum happens. But the tangent lines there are not horizontal, are they? It's only at the interior extreme value, at the minimum, that you get a horizontal tangent. So you have to pick max or min that is in the interior. There's kind of a stupid case where the max and min both happen at the endpoints because the function is actually constant, in which case the max and min also happen at the interior. But okay, if you're careful, and the book is careful, you prove it. But how do you know there's a maximum or a minimum at all? How do you even know the function's bounded? Why did I assume the function was continuous? Right? I mean, we're interested in something that happens in the interior. Why am I so careful to assume something about what happens on the whole interval, including the endpoints? Same height. But there's no horizontal tangent line anywhere to be seen, is there? I mean, you could imagine worse stuff, you know. You could have the function go off to infinity even, right? And then just arbitrarily make an infinite drop at the endpoint, right? You know, even though the rest of the graph has this, you know, vertical asymptote, right? Okay. Yeah, you do need continuity. And what's the theorem that tells us continuity gives us what we need here, right? The problem with these is that I don't actually have the interior min or an interior max, even though they're not constant. But you look at the situation and it's worse than that. In fact, there is no maximum value in either of these, is there? The problem with my counterexamples is that you might have one of the extreme values. Maybe you do have the minimum, but you don't have the other. In my counterexamples, you don't have the maximum value, right? So the theorem that guarantees that this kind of stuff doesn't happen, right? You need this to avoid, these nasty things. That's the extreme value theorem. Right? Which is back from chapter 4, right? Maybe I get lazy and abbreviate EBT, right?
That's what you need. That actually guarantees you have a minimum and a maximum level. And when you combine that with the fact that your endpoints are at the same level, then you can push the proof through. Okay. A good way to make sure you really understand the proof of a theorem is, look at the hypotheses of the theorem and ask yourself, where in the proof was that hypothesis used? And if you really want a challenge, ask yourself, could I come up with a better proof that can do without that hypothesis? Or can I come up with a counterexample that shows what goes wrong when I leave the hypothesis out? These are counterexamples to show that you really can't go without this one. Even if you have the other two, like my pictures do, if you leave out this continuity, including at the endpoints, problems. We use Rolle's theorem down there to, on G, right, to prove the mean value theorem. Okay? That's the point of me bringing up Rolle's theorem in the context of proving the mean value theorem is unslant things, right? And then you pick one of these, maybe you pick this one, right? What happens here? Right? The key observation is that if you compare the derivatives of f and g, so move this stuff here involving x minus a to the other side of the equation, and take the derivative of both sides, what you get is the g of x plus the slope that you want, right? Okay? So when you get g prime of c to be 0, and you get the 0 slope here, then your f prime of c will be 0 plus the slope you actually want. Several ideas in this section. There's this kind of technical technique that doesn't have a theorem to name it, but it's this idea of kind of getting rid of slanted goals. Right? Don't try to find the slanted tangent line. Try to find the horizontal tangent line, because there's some nice theorems to help you do that. Questions, comments? Back to Rolle's theorem again, then. I said it's good to test your understanding by seeing what happens when you try to remove a hypothesis, right? What would happen if we don't assume differentiability here? Right? What if we take away just one point? One bad point.
So we're differentiable on A, but then there's the bad point P in between A and B. But still continuous on the whole interval. And A is less than P is less than B, right? I really do mean there's some point in the middle where I've
not necessarily got a derivative.
And I still have matching endpoint heights. So I just weakened the hypothesis at one point. I'm still demanding continuity, but if I just have one point without a tangent line in the middle somewhere, then we can ask if Rolle's theorem is still true. Is there still some, or maybe I should write it, be absolutely clear here. Must there, right? Does there have to be a point of a horizontal tangent line, or can I come from a counterexample? Must there still be some C where the derivative is zero?
Okay. Maybe one point isn't going to break it. I don't know. Well, I do know, but yeah, you're still thinking about it. Or maybe you can come up with a counterexample. Okay.
Point C equals P, and it's no longer a part of the.
Well, but why can't. Well, maybe C doesn't have to be P. Maybe I could find C somewhere else, right?
The statement says, must there still be, right? So
yeah.
That makes it the case for all cases, even when C equals P.
Well, the question is, given a G meeting the hypotheses, can I find the C, right? Maybe you give me a G and I'm clever enough to find a C that's not P, right? For example, in this G, right, there were four points available. So maybe I can avoid P, right? But maybe that's just, not the right G for a counterexample. Maybe there's a G that would actually make it impossible for me to find a horizontal tangent line. So it's probably worth at least trying to find a counterexample before we dive into an attempted proof. At least spend a little while. So if you've got some paper, maybe make a little few rough sketches. See if you can draw a picture that would be a counterexample. Continuous, differentiable, except at one point in the middle. It doesn't have to be differentiable at the endpoints, but those won't matter here. And no horizontal tangent line. Okay? So there's one bad point in the middle that allows you to avoid the horizontal tangent line. See if you can draw some graph that's like that. Think about some functions you know that are continuous but not differentiable everywhere. That should get you started. Right?
Well, it has to be continuous. Yeah, the rational functions everywhere they're continuously differentiable, so that won't work. But
there are some. I'll let you determine the interval in which it is continuous. It's going to be continuous just in terms of interval. If you set, you make a small interval.
So, addition and multiplication, and division and subtraction, you have all those nice rules for derivatives. So, using just those, everywhere you don't divide by zero, you'll be both continuous and differentiable at the same time. At this point P, it has to be continuous but not differentiable. So think of some other ways you have of making functions besides just arithmetic. What are the other things you can do to make a function?
Absolute value.
Okay, where on the absolute value function is it not differentiable?
At the vertex?
Yes, it's a question.
Yeah. If you have at least one example of differentiable but not continuous, there's a good chance it's the right example for this problem. And how about the interval from negative 1 to 1? So the y-coordinate is the same at the left end and at the right end. But, yeah. No horizontal tangent lines, despite the fact that the graph doesn't have any discontinuities, including no discontinuities at the endpoint. It's all fine. And just that one point. Is a counterexample. So yeah. You need this too. Even taking away one point of differentiability sinks the theorem because there are counterexamples, right? To repeat everything that the section says, because there's never enough time. But, why does theorems pluralize? Right? Yeah, there's also the generalized.
Some other textbooks name this one after Cauchy. So there's the generalized or Cauchy mean value theorem. And you you use this same kind of trick to prove that one from the original.
You have to use a modified function h. Right?
That it's explained. He doesn't give you the full proof. He says use this modified function h. Right? Okay. Okay. So. I think that will be your homework, is to fill in the details of that proof. That's exercise 5. But he gives you a great hint about the modified function to use. And do some algebra on that. And, of course, you probably still remember L'Hopital's rule from calculus. And so if you want to actually prove L'Hopital's rule, down. That's what the generalized or Cauchy mean value theorem is used to prove. There's actually different versions of this. I'll try and match what this author does, which is doesn't put any special mark over the O and uses the S. There's a L'Hopital's rule. So the 0/0 or infinity/infinity rules.
Okay, so that's what all this is really good for, in some sense, in terms of building up the theory. That's the biggest payoff I know of. Well, okay, is there any bigger payoff? I guess
usually people use, you don't have to, but you can use the mean value theorem to prove the fundamental theorem of calculus. Under reasonable assumptions, right? You take the antiderivative at the endpoints and that equals the integral. I should probably not phrase it quite so strongly. Say how it's used in proving this, because 99% of the work is other stuff, right? Just defining this rigorously takes a ton of work. One little step in most proofs of the fundamental theorem of calculus is the mean value theorem. It does come in at one point.
Okay. All right. I don't say anything else.
Another little application. If functions have the same derivatives, then their difference is constant, right? Which is nice, right? Whenever you get an antiderivative, you know it's the only antiderivative up to a plus c, right?
I mean, the precise statement, of course, is given in the book. Gotta let you go. It is now 4:46. So we'll quit. You have your one homework problem. And I look forward to Monday's presentation. All right?